petition number 22333, Reel 11.
This is the sixth reel of a taped interview with Jim McKenzie in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 23rd of the 8th, 2001, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Jim, we've been talking about your situation in regard the people in command and how little they really understood of the situation, but I wanted to speak to you about Brigadier Potts. Could you talk to us about him?
Well, Brigadier Potts, when we first formed up in Northern in 1940, he was Major Headquarter Company, and he eventually became 2IC of the battalion. And then when we went across to the Middle East, he's still 2IC. He had been in the First World War. He was one of the youngest officers commissioned in the First World War in France. He had been wounded and decorated with the Military Cross. And when he came back to Australia, he'd been badly wounded during the war, but he'd returned to his unit, and he came back to Australia with his unit, which was the 16th Battalion, the mother or father unit of our 2nd 16th Battalion. He had kept being associated with the 16th in peacetime, after the First World War. Then he joined the 25th Regiment, Light Horse Regiment, which was a cavalry show. They didn't have horses. And when war broke out, he transferred from that regiment into the 2nd 16th. And he was such a likeable man, very strict discipline man, disciplinarian. The type of disciplinarian that he knew how to treat the troops, and he always gave them a very, very fair go. And when we in the Middle East, he'd been 2IC of the battalion, he'd been right up forward with the advanced troops all the way through Syria, and then after the Syrian campaign, he was given command of the battalion as CO of the 2nd 16th Battalion. And after leaving Syria and coming back to Australia, or before he came back to Australia, he made Brigadier of the two battalions, plus our battalion, which was 2nd 14th, 2nd 16th, and 2nd 27th Battalions. And the troops really liked him. He was a very, very popular man. They knew exactly where they were, Brigadier Potts. And, of course, as I said, the troops liked him. In some cases, you can say they loved him. Because in those days, when you got a commanding officer who understood the men, he was well loved by the men in the battalion. And in the Owen Stanley show, he went up ahead of us. He'd stay with us on the march up, and then he'd leave and go up ahead. He was very strong. His stamina was remarkable for an old or middle-aged man. And he had got a fair idea of the country. And when we staged at Myola, he was very, very annoyed. He's a brigadier then. He's very, very annoyed because we were not getting the supplies we were supposed to be getting. And, of course, the only way of contacting Moresby was by telephone, and I understand it anyway. I don't know whether he used wireless because of the jungle, but he fought very hard for the troops going up to the first time we met the Japs, so that we would be fit and prepared. Unfortunately, the Japs advanced more quickly than expected. They drove the 39th Battalion back. And then when the 14th went up and resisted, held them up for a while, evidently the Japs waited for their reinforcements at that stage. And Potts went up, joined the 2nd 14th Battalion, and then we came up the day afterwards, or 2 days afterwards, I forget which, and we immediately came under his command. And from then on, he commanded the brigade plus the 39th Battalion. And all the time he was trying to get the 2nd 27th Battalion up. But the 2nd 27th Battalion had arrived at Moresby after us, and they were held in Moresby in case the Milne Show came off badly. When the Milne Show developed and we were in command there, they released the 2nd 27th Battalion to come up and join us. Unfortunately, they were late coming up, and it wasn't until Butcher's Hill, the Fogey, that they joined us. But all I can say is that Brigadier Potts looked after the troops all the way. He was on the track all the time with the troops, and it was remarkable that as a brigadier, he did such a really good job.
Mm. I wanted to ask you then what your feelings were in regard how he was treated by higher command for his actions on Kokoda.
Oh, we never knew much about that. When the old fashion in those days, or not the fashion in those days, was that anybody who didn't do well or suffered a defeat had their heads lopped off. And that meant that when we returned to Moresby, the first man who got his head lopped off was Brigadier Pox. And we heard afterwards that Blamey gave no notice that he's going to do this, but he came in, addressed Potts, and told Potts he immediately was going up to Darwin to command a brigade in Darwin. And it was a shock to Pottsy because he'd done very well. We would never heard this, any of this, except one of our officers was present, I didn't know he was present, but he was in an adjoining room and he heard the whole conversation. And afterwards we heard what had happened. But our battalion commander, Caro, he was also dismissed and sent back to Australia and to a command of a depot back in Australia. I understand the general also was demoted. I don't know for sure about that, I just can't remember. But we got a terrific shock there, and we lined up the brigade, what was left of us, there weren't many of us, lined up and addressed by Blamey, and he was very, very, I would say upset. He was very, very, he was very upset, that's the only word I can think of, that with the brigade, and he ran us down in a big way and called us different names. I won't repeat those here, but that's how it was, and the troops took it very badly. They really took it badly, and of course up till that stage Blamey had more or less just been a name to us. In the Middle East we'd see no sign of him except in the distance when he drove past the camp. But when that was the first time we'd had him addressing us man to man, and we were very, very shocked with what he said.
Some of the things he was to say was that only rabbits that run get shot.
That's what he used, how he described us, that we couldn't take it and we ran, and that's why when we were shot. He didn't understand, he'd never been near the jungle. Later on I saw him up in a bit of kunai grass on there, and there was a photo taken of him. I saw the photo later on after the war where Jamie was up at the forward position, and I saw how the jeep he was in. At that stage I'd come back from the Shaggy Ridge show, at Shaggy Ridge position, back to get some stores from headquarters and escort some wounded men down. We came down the track, and then we stopped by this jeep, several jeeps, and we saw General Blamey go into the Kunai grass and stand in the Kunai grass and have his photo taken. I should say that's the nearest he ever got to any jungle fighting or any front action in the whole war.
Mm. With the comments that he was to make, and you mentioned that he blamed you for retreating, Potts was to see, as I understand, this as a tactical defensive withdrawal.
Well, right from the start, when we attacked the Japanese, we attacked them and we lost men. And from then, we were attacking on too wide a front for the small number of men we had compared to what the Japanese had. Mm. And from then on, I think Brigadier Potts saw the futility of fighting in that fashion. He knew he couldn't hold the Japs. They outnumbered us by those numbers. And he planned this strategic withdrawal, where we retreated down the track and held certain positions and stopped the Japs from moving down quickly. When we held these positions, the Japanese came up, found we were in position. There was a firepower went on, firefight developed, and we halted the Japs, and they immediately moved around on our flanks with a larger number of troops. We had no way of combating this at all. And so what Brigadier Potts did was, every now and again, he held the track, made the Japs stop, and try and get around on our flanks, and then we'd withdraw during the night. And this went on for several positions, and we held the Japs like that. And by that time, we understood afterwards that the troops had been able to come from Australia and land in Port Moresby and get ready to move up the track when we eventually got down to Port Moresby, which was what happened.
What sort of effect do you think this form of defence had on the Japanese forces ultimately?
Well, the thing was that their supply became what the same way, displenished in the same fashion as ours. When we moved from Moresby up towards the Japanese through the Yon Stanleys, we didn't have any supplies brought up behind us, because the terrain was too rugged, the track was too rough, and it just couldn't be handled. The Japanese struck the same trouble. They bought carriers, or coolies, whatever you like to call them, from New Britain across, and they used them on the track. And by the time they got down the track to where we eventually met them and defeated them and started to drive them back, they had the same problem we did. And not only that, they had to outflank us, stop and outflank us every time, which delayed the troops, gave, as I said before, time for Moresby to be reinforced, and it tired the Japs out. They had to stop, go into flanking movements, and tire them out. And then when they did these outflankings, they had to then return to the track and come against us again, till we stopped them again. And that's what happened all the time. Maybe I'm not putting it very well because I'm too old, and I can't remember the exact words now that we to be used. But that is what happened, and that is how we delayed the Japs. No. They had the idea that they'd land at Burna and be in Moresby in about 4 or 5 days. It didn't eventuate, and by the time they got near Moresby, their ammunition was short, their supplies, they were starving, more or less, with the dysentery, the malaria that we had struck, and they were in the same position as we were. But in that day, they did not have the troops to reinforce them that we had waiting for us in Moresby.
I think you're doing a very good job of describing things. They were to make it to Imita Ridge, which is very close to Moresby. What was the feeling as they approached that point?
Well, I cannot tell there because I'd been cut off and at Fogey, and I'd gone what we call bush with a number of other chaps, first with the stretcher bearers, with the stretchers, and then the thing. All I can say is what the troops told me, my friends and mates told me afterwards, and how when they got back to Imatra Ridge and they eventually found that 25 pounders, which they had their barrels cut off and lightened so that they could move up the rough, through the rough terrain and come to action against the Japs, they thought it was absolutely wonderful. I believe at that stage there was about 30 or 40 left of our battalion left to fight them.
What was it like going bush? As I understand, it was very easy to get lost in the bush once you were off the track.
Well, we actually never got lost because we could hear the fighting going on distantly over to the right of us coming back. But we couldn't go. We knew that we couldn't get there because the fighting was the fire or the rifle gunfire, not gunfire. The machine gun fire was all ahead of us each time. We knew if we went across, we'd be. Well, we couldn't get across. That was the other word. We couldn't climb up and down the mountains. All the tracks ran along the ridges. And that's how we got onto the tracks on the ridges. At one stage, we were cut off again by the Japs, encountered them, and had a few tough moments before we disengaged. And then we climbed what I thought was the highest mountain in New Guinea. We up the side of this mountain. It took us all day to get up to the top till we struck another track on the top. When you got up there, one of the chaps with me, who'd been a fairly heavy smoker, we met another man from a different battalion, or two or three more men from a different battalion moving along the track. My mate asked him, did he have a smoke? And this chap gave him a smoke, and my mate took a deep breath and immediately fell over. The oxygen, he'd lost so much oxygen going up this tough hill that when he got up and drew this tobacco into his lungs, he just fainted. And that's how tough it was. But we had no food. We fed what food we had to stretcher bearers for the first day. We gave them what we could to them. And after that, we had food for one day. And that's all we had, except once we got a few yams from the village along out the track. And I should say for 6 days we never ate a thing. We just, that week when we sat down, our bladders emptied and we had no control over that, but we kept going. And because we had got rain every night and we got water that way, we never had a bit of food till we got back into Moresby. And then he gave me some bread, and I choked on the bread. But that is how it was. And afterwards I heard how the town had been reinforced at Imatra Ridge and eventually had left there and come back into Moresby.
You mentioned earlier on comrades being killed. You mentioned a chap being shot by a sniper. And I wanted to ask you if you could tell us what it was like to be in a situation when you're under such stress from every other aspect around you, to have your mates fall down beside you.
I'm sorry, but I will not talk about that. I have never spoken about that except a few mates when we come to get together, but I've never discussed it since the war. But it's a terrible thing. It's absolutely shocking. When I got back to Moresby, I made inquiries with the RMO, the medical officer, regimental medical officer, about morphine, because I understood that you could have a needle of morphine and you could inject that into a wounded man when he's almost past suffering, and that would calm him down. And he told me then that they had supplied the morphine they issued to the stretcher bearers. We didn't know about. The stretcher bearers had a little haversack, and that they had a few bandages, and then they had a couple of these morphine, I think it was two or three morphine needles. We didn't know about it. The whole show, it's, you can't talk about it. In one case, I'll just mention one case, mm-hmm. where a man was badly wounded in the stomach, and we, from the time we went away, left Northern, we had a little, what they call a shell dressing, a little dressing about 4 inches by 4 inches, bandages, and the idea was that when you carried that always, and when you were wounded, you used it for your wound. Now, in this case, that man would have needed a dressing about 10 inches by 10 inches in his stomach wound. We just didn't have anything, and all we could do was hold a little patch on his wound till he died. But that is all. I will not talk again about anything about the fighting.
Okay. Tell us then what your next involvement was. You were to come back to Moresby. What was the feeling then of having been on Kokoda and now you're in Moresby, safe again?
Well, I went to a CCS. I suppose you call it, nowadays called dehydration or something like that. I went there for 2 or 3 days, or might have been a bit more, 3 or 4 days. That was a field dressing station, CCS, up towards the front line. It was a tent show and attended by one or two doctors, and it was, the treatment was very good till they moved you away to a general hospital. Take you back to Moresby, where there's three hospitals, or two hospitals. And while I was there, I got a commission in the field, one of four that got it in the whole show. And I returned the battalion, and the few that were left, that's when Blamey addressed us and gave us this, ran us down. And then we went back to Moresby, and we got a few reinforcements, not many. I think maybe in half a dozen that had joined us while we were way up at Owen Stanley's. And of course we had a few of the nucleus left that we hadn't joined, that we hadn't taken into Owen Stanley's. And there we did training, pretty hard training, while we built up our strength. And then we got the orders to move to Gona. And that is when I just in the plane and I got malaria, and I can say that saved my life. I think I can save my life. Because the battalion went into Gona. It wasn't nowhere near full strength, of course, I think it was about 500 in full strength, 450 with our strength then. And nearly every lieutenant got killed. We had one lieutenant that came out alive, to my knowledge, was badly wounded. And the strength of our battalion, we came out of Gona, including officers, and a couple, two or three men attached to it, with 49 men or 50 men, that all was left after Gona. And they came back and joined us in Moresby. As I said before, I was very, very lucky that I didn't have to go to Gona. Some of them, of course, malaria and typhus, scrub typhus, weakened the battalion extremely over there. It was pretty deadly. And some of them died over there of illness while they were at Gona. They were buried at Popmandet or Dobadura, and then we came back to Moresby, and from there we immediately got leave, or after a few days we got leave we got on a boat and went across to Cairns, and then it's hard to speak about it. Mm-hmm. We treated wonderfully. We got on the train and we went up to the tableland, the tablelands, and there the people gave us a wonderful time. Hard to talk about.
With regard to the comments that Blamey had made, and the fact that, as I understand, MacArthur was pretty disappointed that the withdrawal had brought the Japanese so close to Port Moresby, how did you personally feel about the Kokoda experience and what you'd achieved personally?
Oh, I think the whole battalion was very proud of that. The thing was that we knew we were winning. The other, the 25th Brigade and the other battalions, I think it was the 3rd and the 9th, they went up the Kokoda track under General Allen, who was a very popular officer. He'd been our general in Syria, or one of the generals in Syria. He had been very popular, and he had not understood the track, even though he's a good friend of Potsy. He and Potsy were very close, I think, well heard. But he did not understand the track, and he started off with his divisional headquarters and Brigadier Doherty, who was a very, very good soldier. He distinguished himself in the Middle East, and he became our brigadier later on. And he... No, I'm wrong there. Brigadier Doherty didn't go up the track. After Gona, he rejoined us in the Tablelands. Now, the thing was that Alan soon found out the conditions on the track, and he found out that he had to do the same sort of movements that the Japs had to do against us. Mm. That was go up till he struck the Japs where they're holding the track, then do flanking movements and go round them on the flanks and force them to withdraw. They had to withdraw. They were starving by then, and they suffered heavily with dysentery, and they had to do... Now, we understood this. We knew that our side were winning there. Before we left board, we knew that. And then when we got to... We were very cheerful because we were going home. Mm. And then we got this greeting by everybody who came down to the train and met us. And then we went into Ravenshoe, and we went straight into tents and good tucker. And it made all the difference. Mm. The welcome that we'd got from the people in the Tableland. Now, there again, I think that the people in outback Australia, like we struck in West Australia, were the same. And the people in northern Queensland were totally different to people in southern Queensland. The way they lived, the way their towns were smaller, and everything like that. They were totally different people. And they realised, when they saw us, how we looked.
Yeah.
And they treated us accordingly.
Yeah.
And after we'd been very well treated up there by the citizens, we didn't have much leave. I don't remember what leave we had, actually. It was very short. We were given leave to come back home to Western Australia. And all our troops were West Australians, and we were given leave to come back. Now, there again, I'll emphasise the stupidity of the army. For the first time, they gave paid the troops at Ravenshoe, and for their services. That is the money that they're entitled in their paybook. And that money was given to the troops in cash. I had the job of looking after it in a big box in the tent with a silly I don't know how to explain it. It was so silly. With a sentry outside with a bayonet, rifle and a bayonet. And they gave that money to our troops, and then we had to come home through Brisbane, through Melbourne, through Sydney, through Melbourne, through Adelaide to Perth. Now, you give a lot of money to a certain type of soldier, and he can't hold that money. So by the time he got back to Perth, in several cases, the money had gone. The soldiers spent it on the way back, either on food, drink, or something like that.
Mm.
And it was just a stupidity. That was the only time it ever happened. Afterward, we'd come back on leave and withdraw our pay out of our home, wherever we went at home. Say Perth, we'd come back to Perth and withdraw our pay there.